And welcome everyone to today's media-only teleconference examining future distress in the automotive sector. The prospect of consumers cutting back on spending and credit markets tightening intensify the financial distress for the automotive sector. Despite adjustments to their recovery plans and a $25 billion loan package from the government, automakers and parts manufacturers continue to face a grim future. Joining us today are a panel of experts specializing in automotive company restructurings. They will be discussing the problems currently being experienced in the marketplace, as well as what future trends might lie ahead for the automotive sector. The program will consist of about 30 to 40 minutes of opening commentary, and then we will take your questions. Our speakers include Deborah L. Thorne, a partner at Barnes & Thornburg in Chicago. Also joining us is Ronald J. Silverman, a partner with Bingham McCutcheon in New York. Finally, Ben Pickering is a senior managing director at Messero Financial Consulting in New York as well. Our moderator for the program will be Professor Jack Williams, ABI's resident scholar. I'll now turn it over to our moderator, Jack Williams.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you, folks, again. For joining us today, we've got a lot of issues we'd like to discuss. But before we hit the particular issues, I'd like to ask Ben Pickering to kind of frame the environment in which the issues that we're going to address swim. Ben, would you like to go ahead and do that?
Sure, Jack. Thanks very much. Good afternoon, everyone. It's Ben Pickering here from Messero Financial. And as Jack mentioned, and as all of you have been following, I'm sure plenty of change in the automotive industry. And in particular, one of the focuses that we have is looking at what happens to the automotive parts suppliers, as that really has been the kind of the culmination of issues prior to what we're seeing now in the press with respect to the potentials for merger between GM and Chrysler and stuff like that. But let me back up a little bit and just talk a little bit of what happens with the automotive parts supplier industry, because that really has been the stress point in the supply chain so far. Certainly, the big three OEMs, the GM, Ford, Chrysler, have struggled to trim their costs, trim their production as demand has decreased. We've certainly seen a number of Chapter 11 filings of their Tier 1 suppliers. Dana, Delphi, Citation, Oxford, Collins and Aikman, Meridian, Cadence, you name it. There's been a wide variety across a wide range of suppliers. They have certainly been a trickle down from the Tier 1s to the Tier 2s in that chain of events. And really what you're seeing is in part it's due to the reduction in volume. Prior to the most recent significant reduction in volumes, you saw a lot of migration of production to the extent that it could be migrated out of the U.S. into Mexico or even from overseas. And so that's also had some stress on the supplier industry here in the U.S. As well, what you've seen is the what we call the imports, the sort of non-domestics like Honda, Nissan, et cetera, who have brought with them into the U.S. their own suppliers. And, of course, if they're coming into the U.S. to open up their own production facilities, they've asked their Tier 1 and Tier 2 suppliers to follow them into the North American market and construct from new as well. That, of course, leads to a very different competitive nature. They have much reduced legacy costs. And therefore, they have a competitive advantage. So what you're seeing as well is there's been an attempt to migrate from a lot of these suppliers' perspectives, the domestic ones trying to latch on to the imports to take advantage of a new players in the market. But they're finding that difficult given their legacy cost issues. Other factors sort of driving the depression in the auto parts industry would be modularization. That really is the OEMs increasingly expecting their suppliers to provide pre-assembled combinations of components and complete automotive interiors rather than just individual components. Again, increased outsourcing has happened at the OEMs, and they're asking for just-in-time sequencing, which really adds additional manufacturing time and complexities to the Tier 1. growing technological content as well. You're seeing a lot of technology expanding, and that really provides the competitive edge for the OEMs, and so they're asking for the Tier 1s to provide that technological content. And so the savvy suppliers are the ones who have technological advances. The ones that are more commodity-based really are the ones that are having even more difficulty. Globalization as well. Significant cost savings are being seen by the OEMs by globalizing some of their supply chain. Raw material costs, of course, which we'll talk a lot more about shortly, is certainly impacting. What's happening with raw materials just in general is, of course, the suppliers to the Tier 1s and Tier 2s are asking for price increases. The Tier 1s and Tier 2s don't have as strong of a means to fight that, so they absorb the cost, and then they try and pass it on to the OEMs, who basically either through contract or through just their strength say no. And so you do end up with a squeeze at the Tier 1 level. As well, a lot of the regulatory changes recently, particularly, for example, the EPA-compliant engines and things like that in the commercial sector, has led to, again, more technological advances, more costs at the Tier 1 level that the OEMs are less willing to absorb. Just moving into, again, things like raw materials, just give you some examples. I think you're all aware of where oil traded at in mid-July of this year at $147 a barrel. That was a record high. That has obviously impacted costs of any polymer-based product, resins, for example, when they do any plastic injection molding for vehicles. That can be very costly. And I mentioned this similar in a presentation 2 weeks ago when oil was at $80 a barrel. I noticed today it's at $68 a barrel. So, you know, that price is fluctuating a great deal. You might think that that would provide a benefit to the Tier 1 suppliers in the sense that they can, you know, now see a cost reduction. Unfortunately, what's happened, and this was confirmed yesterday at a meeting that I was at with actually a Tier 1 supplier who's in the injection molding business, they said that their suppliers are unfortunately saying, we don't believe that it's going to stay at that level, and therefore we have two issues. One is we've got inventory that was bought at the $147 a barrel level or something in that vicinity, and it still has to work its way through our system, and therefore we're not reducing our price. Or two, we're not going to sell at a lower price only to find that our replacement raw material for our end is going to be at a higher level, and so they're hesitant to reduce their prices. Steel is another one that broke $1,000 a ton recently, and obviously lots of steel in an automobile. Just compare that for a second when LTV failed back in 1991, I believe it was, 92. When LTV failed, hot rolled was at $190 a ton. Today, close to $1,000 a ton. I think it's $850 or somewhere in that vicinity right now for hot roll. But it did crack $1,000 a ton not that long ago. So again, those are the kinds of constraints that are being pushed back onto the Tier 1 suppliers, which is why you're seeing a lot of difficulties in that area. And I think, again, legacy costs, and I'll turn it over to my other speakers here to talk about that as well. I think legacy costs such as pension, OPEB, salaries, all have created a competitive disadvantage in that area.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ben. This is Ron Silverman from Bingham McCutcheon. I think that legacy costs are a singularly huge problem for the automotive industry, particularly, of course, the OEMs, but also the large Tier 1 and maybe even some Tier 2 manufacturers. And I think that if we look back, there's some precedent to how some industries have dealt with legacy costs, like pension costs, like retiree benefits, like health benefits, disability benefits, things like that, and may give us a little bit of a foreshadowing of how the automotive industry might deal with some of those legacy costs in order to reduce and manage them to try and right-size themselves going forward. If we look back, we see first with the steel industries, and then following that over a period of years with the airlines, as those industries and companies in those industries entered where they had to Chapter 11 cases, they were able to crystallize the pension liabilities, and our bankruptcy laws give companies the ability to also crystallize and even and modify and reduce collective bargaining costs, things like health care and disability benefits that are otherwise very hard to modify outside of bankruptcy, so that you could quantify them, you could crystallize them, and you could treat them with a payment plan or some sort of form of compensation, so the companies can get those behind them and move on without that cost overhang that many of newer companies who are their competitors don't have. So the steel companies and the airline companies have been able to do that. What is likely to happen is beginning to happen now in the automotive sector. As Ben was saying, we see competitors to the American automotive companies coming in at a later stage, the foreign competition. They don't have the same type of legacy costs, union contracts, and collective bargaining agreements that the big three have, and some of the large tier ones have. So obviously there's a competitive cost disadvantage to the U.S. companies, and it's quite likely, we think, that we've seen with large tier ones and maybe even with some OEMs, that they'll be using Chapter 11 to try and address those pension liabilities and reduce those, then get more in a cost-competitive situation. And a little bit later in the presentation, we'll discuss a little bit in more detail of how actually there'll be some particular techniques that may be used more frequently in the future to reduce the size and the scope of pension liabilities.
This is Deborah Thorne from Barnes & Thornburg. I was just going to add that even if we were able to look at a crystal ball, but looking back on the airlines and the steel, not every airline went in, but because the other airlines were able to go in and strip some of these costs move them off their balance sheet, the other airlines were able to deal more effectively with their unions and become more competitive. So it may be that as we move forward, if one goes in, or even, I suppose, to a certain extent, if you're really good at negotiating, they may be able to explain to their unions what this would mean and get a little bit more leverage in terms of dealing with them head-on outside of bankruptcy, but more likely in.
As well, I think one of the other important factors here that's now obviously come to the forefront for the OEMs is simply their reduction in volume. That's really created a lot of overcapacity now. Production is down. I think if you look at some of the recent announcements, I think Ford was going to close 14 plants by 2012. I think GM announced they were going to do 9. They announced at the beginning of the year they're going to do 9 plant closures. I think they added more closures after that, including, of course, SUVs and pickups and things like that. I think all across the U.S., I think sales are estimated to decline somewhere like 13% this year from where they were last year. And that really equates to around 2 million fewer vehicles being produced in the U.S. this year. Clearly, that's an issue that, as Deborah and Ron mentioned, as far as the union issue, the legacy cost issue, I think everyone recognizes that a volume decline impacts everybody extremely adversely. A lot of the OEMs and the parts manufacturers are doing their best to try and consolidate production into fewer facilities and doing their own kind of restructuring that way operationally, and getting a little bit more savvy as to how they do that. But again, I think the OEMs are looking for how do they get their costs reduced by looking at alternatives for parts production as well. Now, that kind of sounds like a little bit of gloom and doom for the automotive parts industry in the U.S., and I think it's important to point out that manufacturing in the U.S. is not going to go away from the automotive perspective. You certainly are going to have the need for production in the U.S. I think it would be cumbersome and costly to try and import fully produced vehicles from other places, which is why you have the non-domestics, the imports coming into the country and building facilities here. They've recognized that they can make a better dollar by having their production here. As a result, then, does that mean that parts supply is going to go away from the U.S.? The answer to that is no as well. A lot of the just-in-time production, a lot of the quality control needs to be done, and that's why it needs to be done in the U.S., right nearby the OEM facility. And so that's why you'll see the positioning of a lot of the Tier 1 manufacturing is placed very close to the OEMs that they supply. And as a result, again, I don't think the automotive industry is going to go away in the U.S., but I certainly think we're at the front end of a significant change as to what you're seeing. A lot of talk goes around the domestic OEMs feeling the impact of this, and it was interesting. I spoke recently with some folks who do operational restructuring for the automotive industry, and I asked them if they were starting to see any of the imports and the import suppliers having issues as well. And the answer to that was, for the first time, yes. There are some as well. So the volume decline is not just hitting the big three, but it's hitting the imports as well now. And again, I think that's just a general decline across the board. We're just seeing it at a larger scale because of the big three and where they're coming from a cost perspective, particularly on the legacy issue side. I think as well, Ron and Deborah, we had a discussion before regarding the volume of inventory at the actual dealerships, and I don't know if you guys want to comment further on that.
I think everybody probably knows that the pressure on the dealers is coming from a lot of different places. Clearly, people are buying fewer cars. It's much more difficult to finance the purchase of individual cars. GMAC is struggling to borrow, to have money to lend. In fact, I saw recently, or I think this week in Automotive News, a report talking about the credit unions in Virginia picking up some of the slack. They are actually able to lend money more advantageously, or coming in and trying to work with directly with the dealers to pick up this, so that if an event somebody actually wants to buy a car these days, there's somebody there to buy the paper. And there are other credit unions that have been doing this around the country. Some of our clients have been doing this for a long period of time, but are stepping up when their actual sales. But meanwhile, the dealers are having a huge amount of pressure on the individual dealers in terms of their floor plan financing themselves. And so they're really getting caught in the crunch. And I think we're going to see, and we are seeing now, a lot of consolidation among dealers that have existed for, 50 years, going out of business and just, really not able to make it, as they're finding that their floor plans are being really ratcheted back. So that's just another, I guess, trickle down from not only from the OEM pressure, but also from just the general instability in the general economy.
And consumers are getting strapped for cash. As we know, if you think of consumer debt as a kind of stool with three legs to it, a lot of attention has been paid to the home mortgage leg, then there's the credit card leg, and then the third major leg of consumer debt is auto financing. And we've seen, as Deborah was pointing out, a constriction and restriction and access to funds and attempts to become more creative to promote and enhance consumer buys in this industry. But we're probably looking at an increase in bankruptcy filings is just one indicator of financial distress, from about 800,000 last year to over 1.2 million for calendar year 2008. So on the revenue side, it doesn't look like things are going to get any better soon, assuming that there's nothing that's drastic or dramatic that happens in the short term. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, Jack, it's Ron Silverman. I do agree with that, and I think with respect to the financing angle, I think there's a little bit of a double whammy that's going on right now because of the sort of the global credit crunch. It's coming at the auto manufacturing sector or the automotive retailing sector two ways. First, as the economy contracts and businesses in general contract, consumers, like you were saying, feel less confident. They have less disposable income to purchase automobiles, and that drives down demand. But the other angle is the consumer, the global credit crunch is also affecting directly the automotive companies and their financing arms, as Deborah was saying, directly to the financing companies as opposed to the consumers. It's making it more difficult for the automotive companies to provide financing to the consumers. so that consumers are able to borrow less and therefore buy less of a car. And what we might be seeing now, sort of the first time in 20 years, is 20 years ago, before the leasing industry and the automotive sector got prevalent, you know, when you wanted to buy a car, you put down 20% and you financed the rest. So to get your first car, you saved up money, you got 20%, you got a loan, you bought your car. And 5-6 years later, when the loan was paid down, you still had hopefully something that was worth some money. You had equity in your car, hopefully. And that was your 20% for your next purchase. With the leasing industry, there's no equity built up in the car. You use all your money to get a car, but at the end of the 3 years, you give the car back. And as long as you can get another nice low interest rate on, effective interest rate on your lease to get a new car, that works well. But when someone stops offering that product, you're not able to do that. You're not able to buy, if you will, as much of a car next time around. And I think that's what we're beginning to see in this cycle. And that's a double whammy that's hitting the automotive sector, both from the consumer end and the financing end.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. It's Ben with another comment on how the liquidity in the marketplace is impacting, and that's simply on the restructuring side of things, both in and out of bankruptcy. What we had seen before, and I've got a long list here in front of me of M&A activity in the industry, where parts suppliers were being gobbled up by other suppliers or by private equity funds, hedge funds were getting into that industry as well. With the liquidity crunch, what we've seen now is that the M&A activity is significantly declining. If it hasn't already almost dried up, there has been I think there's still activity from the strategic buy perspective. In other words, other suppliers looking to buy added volume strategically within their business, but we're seeing the segment that used to do the private equity and the hedge fund type buys aren't as prevalent as now. It's not that they've dried up, but I think they're being a lot more selective in what they're looking for. So as a result, when you've got a company that's struggling, whether it be in or outside of a Chapter 11, you know, that M&A solution is not necessarily there anymore. As well, they used to finance themselves out of some of their difficulties. That has also dried up as well. So that creates certainly an issue with respect to the ability and the time that the suppliers can weather the storm. And as you've got volumes declining for a variety of reasons, as you've just heard, that again creates difficulties in the solution that you get at the other end. I think a lot of it is you got soft retail demand, high inventory, the mix is changing. Consumers are now looking towards hybrids. It's become the flavor, away from the SUVs. That creates a lot of retooling, for lack of a better term, at the OEM level, and which means now they're angling towards not building the SUV, but now building more of a smaller vehicle with a hybrid solution to it. That, again, trickles down the chain to the Tier 1s and Tier 2s, who also have to take that focus. In order to do all that retooling, of course, you need capital to invest, and that is difficult for a lot of folks to obtain at the moment. So, again, the liquidity crunch has had that kind of an impact as well.
You know, I would add, though, that there, I do see activity coming from, in particular from Japanese manufacturers, and interest in Japan, where there is some money still out there to invest in coming in and making some strategic buys into what I guess they would call a distressed market, as long as it's away from Detroit. I think there's still a significant amount of interest in purchasing parts manufacturers that may be closer to Indiana, Wisconsin, Western Michigan, maybe where there are no union issues, but where they have Japanese OEMs or maybe Korean located, you know, nearby. So I do see that. And the other thing I would just add in terms of the Japanese manufacturers is that a lot of the Japanese Tier 1s, more Tier 2s and Tier 3s are selling also to the domestic OEMs. And so that brings the problems into the Japanese OEMs in particular, because their parts manufacturers on down the line have been hurt by the problems within the crunch and the squeeze from the domestic OEMs. But I do believe that there is interest in coming in and doing some, maybe picking off some good companies, because there is money to invest and there's interest. And now, because the Japanese have been here for so long, they have, I think, a more sophisticated view of using bankruptcy as a tool to do this, where maybe 10 years ago they were very reluctant to have anything to do with bankruptcy in the United States. Now they have a much better understanding and are interested in using it as a tool to help them purchase companies.
Yeah, Deb, it's Ron. I would echo that. I think Ben is absolutely right that the amount of the, you know, at the current stage, the amount of financing that's being done to leverage acquisitions is reduced. But that being said, both on the strategic side, and you know, we do a lot of work with the, you know, the hedge fund industry, particularly the part that's focused on perhaps distressed industries, that's focused is looking at the automotive businesses right now. And there are funds with cash put aside. They're biding their time. They are looking to try and make smart purchases and get good value. But there is the interest there to purchase, particularly, you know, suppliers. They think that where they think they're, you know, good opportunities. So we do think that there'll be continued M&A activity, and that'll increase as well once the credit markets reopen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Ron. I think when the credit markets open up, I think you'll see a pickup again in that M&A activity. And Deborah, to your point, I think what I'm seeing in the variety of the actual file cases is that there is more interest from foreign than there is from domestic. It hasn't completely dried up. Don't get me wrong. I just think that the level of activity that we saw a year or 2 years ago, when there was a lot of people vying for these assets, certainly I've seen a significant reduction in that activity or that interest level.
Well, do you folks then see the strategic use of bankruptcy and Bankruptcy Code 363 sales as being the vehicle by which many of these acquisitions will take place? And then I should say the follow-up question to that would be, are we going to see any old-fashioned supplier rehabilitations in Chapter 11?
I think, at least in terms of people making strategic buys, and I'm particularly talking about Japanese companies coming in making strategic buys, that they are thinking, if they can do this, that they would like to do it through maybe even a prepackage, so that they don't go through. They're a little wary, interestingly enough, of 363 as a vehicle. They'd like to do the whole thing and be done. They don't want it to stretch out. But they are very interested in using bankruptcy as a way to cleanse the assets.
So you the profile of a case would be a very quick, a lot of flurry on the front end, and in and out, at least from the major part or substantially all the asset side, in 3 months or less.
That would be the hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jack. This is Ron. I also see that with respect to somewhat larger purchases. The flip side, where we could see what we call 363 sales, referring to a section of our bankruptcy law, is where you have a larger company that's trying to reorganize, and it's in a Chapter 11 proceeding, and it's got some good operations, got some maybe some balance sheet and some financial problems that it needs to restructure, but there's a business there, but it may have some non-core operations that it's looking to hive off, so it can right-size and get down to more of a core operation. You'll see the 363, the sort of the one-time sales in Chapter 11s. And I think you'll continue to see those, particularly with respect to both the strategics and the financial buyers, who may look to do those for two reasons. First, they think they can pick up similarly situated operations and consolidate and form new types of tier one and two tier suppliers by picking up the operations at good prices. And number two, the view that we've been hearing is that when you have an operation that does actually make something, as opposed to just being purely a service company, people are thinking they will still be able to finance those. Those will be hard assets. They will actually make something. As long as you can right-size the costs, they will be worth something, even if they ultimately have to grant liens on it to get financing, there are assets there to finance. That's different than a service business. So we do see financial buyers with their minds open towards, individual smaller, relatively smaller acquisitions as well.
The other issue in there, Ron, is another factor, is a lot of the folks are going back now, be they the incumbent or a potential purchaser, going back to the OEMs and asking for pricing concessions. I mean, you can only do that so much, but particularly in a time of distress, it's your best opportunity to go back to an OEM and ask for a price increase of some kind. Be it justified either through, it's better if you've got means to do that, such as raw material price increases that you had been unable to pass along, has made it untenable for you, or just simply that the metrics don't work based on volume or whatnot. But being able to go back to the OEMs, I think they're getting peppered with those requests. Certainly over the last number of years, from their suppliers, they're being peppered with those requests. I think if you've got a unique product as well, I think that really helps to the extent that you produce something that maybe no one else does. Or you've got technology that the OEM really likes and it's a good seller, I think that gives you a competitive advantage when you're asking for those concessions.
Well, I have a bigger question. We often get a question about the 2005 amendments to the bankruptcy code. And from where you stand on the issues that we've discussed, and particularly this market, do you think the changes in the 2005 code, in particular things like the 20-day administrative claim and the like, period of exclusivity of proposing a plan, leases and executory contracts all being shortened, and arguably the removal of the discretion of the bankruptcy judge on a number of these issues is going to help, hurt, or is indifferent to reorganizations in this particular sector?
I think the 20-day administrative claims is enormous and is becoming more enormous. Just in case the people on the call don't know, when the code was amended in 2005, any deliveries of goods which were made to a debtor 20 days before the filing of the case are given an administrative priority over other general unsecured claims, and those have to be paid 100% of those 20-day delivery invoices at the time of confirmation, or and if the vendor agrees to something less, I guess it can be that, but it's generally it's going to be 100%. And just an example, in the Plastec case, which is pending in Detroit, $26 million in 20-day claims were filed as these administrative claims. I believe Plastec thinks they're going to be able to reduce those to about $17 million, but that's a huge dollar amount that has to be paid upon confirmation, and this is a liquidating plan, but you can only imagine if it was an actual reorganization, the amount of additional cash that the debtor has to know it's going to be able to get through the process. In the old days, those would just be unsecured claims and would be paid on a pro rata basis. So I think that tension between a debtor contemplating going in, its lender on one part, and the vendors delivering goods is enormous, and I think it's made confirmation of a reorganization extremely difficult, and I think it's one reason why, besides exclusive period being shortened and some other things, I think that's one of the real reasons why we just aren't seeing reorganizations. It's very expensive to get through the process.
And the other angle on that is some of the changes that Jack referenced do shorten the put pressure on or shorten the time frame of Chapter 11 cases. It's now the companies don't have the same amount of time before they have to make some decisions, and as a result of that, one of two things will happen. They'll probably plan better for their reorganization and make some decisions earlier, and if they don't, it opens the door towards other parties other than the company, whether creditors or other investors, being able to put their own proposals on the table for the company. So those things together should probably shorten, not lengthen, the time frame for reorganization and Chapter 11 proceedings going forward.
Well, folks, we're just about out of time. I was wondering if we could wrap it up with an exit question for all of you. And if I could use the discretion of the moderator, I'd ask each of you to address this question. What do you see as the future of the automotive sector, both short and long term? Ben, how about if we kick it off with you?
Sure. Yeah, I think I partially addressed that in what I mentioned before. I don't think we're going to see the automotive sector in the U.S. Go away. But I think in the near term, we're going to see continued struggles mainly because of liquidity and volume. That is certainly going to trickle down to the tier ones and below, depending on how they can absorb those costs. Again, there's been a lot of requests for pricing concessions from the OEMs, and obviously, given their current struggles and situation, I'm not sure that they can afford to do that to any great extent now as well. So that is creating quite a pinch in the industry. I think for the first time we're seeing that pinch floating its way up to the OEM level now, and that's why you're seeing the news that GM, Chrysler talks, that kind of issue. So I think short term we'll certainly see some more bankruptcy filings, particularly at the supplier level. And in the longer term, I don't think the industry is going away. I think it's just going to be readjusted, right-sized per se.
Thank you, Ben. How about you, Deborah?
Well, I certainly agree that there are going to be, there'll be many fewer parts suppliers. They're obviously going to be in different geographic areas. I mean, if Janesville is closing down the GM plant there, there'll be fewer parts suppliers right in that immediate area. So I think we're going to see, a lot of little towns that had a number of them kind of disappear. And I think the suppliers will disappear as well. But they certainly will be there. I also think that, it's going to be a push for more innovation. Long term, those are the companies that are going to survive. If you look at what's going on with Toyota in terms of how popular the Prius is, they were just ahead of us on that. I assume that there's going to be more innovation. And a lot of it also depends on what happens after the election. There may be rewards out there for innovation that we don't even see now.
Thank you. Ron, we'll give you the last word on that question.
Okay, thanks. I agree. We'll continue to see consolidation. It's an industry that's having financial difficulty. The weak will shake out. The stronger will survive. But in that shakeout, inevitably, companies will resort to the use of the Chapter 11 forum. And I think what we will see is increased litigation in that forum. There'll be smaller pots to divvy up. When that happens, people fight over the amount in the pot to a greater degree. And there are significant wins and losses to be had in that Chapter 11 forum of how the company will restructure and how the investors will come out of it. And there is the ability through litigation for people to come out better or come out worse, and we'll I think that we'll be seeing that.
All right, thank you. Ben, Deborah, and Ron, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. Elizabeth, at this time, we're ready to take any questions our audience may have.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once more, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And our first question comes from Chris Cinta from Bloomberg News. Please go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, as a result of the tight situation in the credit markets, there's a substantial lack of dip financing. And so do more of these cases that might start out as potential reorganizations end up being liquidations or 363 sales? And does that result in just larger suppliers as these things get bought up, or does that just result in fewer suppliers altogether?
It's Ben here. I'll take the first crack at that one. I think the answer is, in part, it depends. It really depends on what that supplier, if they're having trouble financing, that puts them into a certain realm of what do they supply. And I think if there is competitive suppliers, alternative suppliers out there for the OEMs to turn to, then perhaps we're going to see that supplier will go away. But again, I think if there's something unique that they're supplying, or if they are the only supplier of that product that has the capacity to supply, you know, it has to survive in some way. And again, you know, you're seeing it in certain sized cases. You're seeing the OEMs stepping up to provide some of that financing to keep those companies in place while they transition. So I think the answer is it really depends on the type of product that they've got, the ability of the OEM to resource, and how important they are.
And once more, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Our next question comes from Marty Schladen of the Journal Gazette. Please go ahead.
Hi. During some of your comments, you said that part of the disadvantage American auto manufacturers are at is due to legacy costs. And I wanted to know if you'd comment on what you think about the management of these automakers. You know, I think you could have looked 5 years ago and known that demand for oil was going to go up in the long term, that family wages were stagnant, yet it doesn't seem that, well, it seems that American auto manufacturers were beaten to market with the kinds of cars that are in demand today. So do you lay any of this at the doorstep of the management of the auto manufacturers, the American auto manufacturers?
I'll jump in here. Go ahead. Is there someone else?
This was Jack speaking. And why don't you go ahead?
Okay. I was just going to say, you know, my experience has been that from what we have seen in the restructuring of, you know, what a variety of companies that we've worked on, is that I think you'll see a mixture between, good management and bad management. I think bad management, you know, you can understand what the issue is and why it failed. Good management always begs the question of, well, why does a good management, a smart operator, run into trouble? And again, part of it comes back to the product that they supply. Part of it comes back to the ability to pass along raw material price increases to the OEM, as well as obtain pricing concessions for any other factors that you've got. So I would certainly say that, you know, at times you could place it on the backs of management, but I think most of the management that I've experienced has been very good, and just they're caught in a difficult situation. You got to remember that this is a very linear supply chain. When you go through PPAP, which is the production part approval process, it really makes it difficult for both the supplier and the OEMs, quite frankly, to look for alternatives. You know, it's a long process to get to an approval with an OEM to produce a part for them, and which is a terrific win, but it also means that for you to get lead time on business elsewhere, it's a long time. Conversely, for the OEMs, they say, well, it's not easy for us to resource because it does take us time as well. So it really creates a joint relationship. Depending on which party has the stronger position will really depend on whether you can get the pricing concessions you need or pass on raw material costs, et cetera, or fight against that. So, long-winded way of saying, I think my experience has been that most management has been good. They could see the problem coming. They just were kind of hamstrung at what they could do.
And once more, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch tone phone. We'll pause a moment for questions to enter the queue. And it appears that we have no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Again, I want to thank the panel members, Ben Pickering, Deborah Thorne, and Ron Silverman for some wonderful comments and sharing your experience and our expertise with us today. And of course, I want to thank the ABI for sponsoring this and our audience for their participation as well. If you have any follow-up questions, you can reach any of the panel members or me through John Hartkin here at the ABI. Please feel free to use that resource. And with that, I wish everyone a great afternoon. Bye-bye.